From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a meeting of top Michigan CEOs brings new faces to the table.
What I thought was really remarkable was here you had this collection of CEOs, and there wasn't a single automotive person involved in this thing from top to bottom.
It's the 75th anniversary of folklorist Alan Lomax's trip to Michigan collecting songs.
The roots of who we are as a state were documented by Lomax.
We find out why snow this year could be early and heavy.
I think we're talking more white Thanksgiving than white Christmas this year.
And Halloween's of Michigan's past, much more trick than treat.
Kids had stretched almost invisible piano wire across the sidewalk, and when people went walking by, they would trip.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder and Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr both took to the stand this week at Detroit's bankruptcy trial. That's as business leaders met in the city to discuss the future. We'll look at these two contrasting events later on today's show. And then, just how was Halloween celebrated decades and decades ago in Michigan? We've got some surprising stories coming your way later in the hour. But first, beginning tomorrow, families who rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, are going to have to tighten their proverbial belts even more. That's because a temporary boost in the food stamp funding is expiring as of November 1st, and that means SNAP recipients will see benefits shrink. Melissa Smith is a senior policy analyst for the Michigan League for Public Policy. Welcome back to Stateside, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what's behind this drop in food stamp benefits.
Well, actually, this temporary increase to the benefits was initially designed to kind of float with the economy until it got better and then fade off and go back to where we would normally be with our food stamp benefits. But because of budget cuts at the federal level, that has been cut back on in order to find savings. And so we've now moved it all the way back here to November 1st, 2013, and people are going to lose benefits, even though the economy has not recovered in a sufficient way to help all of these people find employment and put food on their tables.
So this temporary stimulus package, and it's expiring sooner than expected.
Yes.
And what does it mean here in Michigan in terms of dollars and cents?
Well, it's actually $183 million in benefits in fiscal year 2014 alone that we'll see cut not only out of families' pocketbooks, but out of our economy. SNAP dollars are incredible because they are spent almost immediately and almost entirely in the local market. And so they're great for building the economy and creating jobs. Not only do we lose the ability of families to fully feed themselves, but we also lose an opportunity to continue putting money into the economy.
Give us an idea, if you would, how many people in Michigan rely on food stamps to feed their families?
Yes. Currently, there's about 1.8 million people that are receiving food assistance in some manner in Michigan, and that's about 18% of our population. Of those 1.8 million folks, almost half are children, about 43%. About 26% are elderly or people with disabilities. We have a lot of veterans also that are receiving food assistance.
And is there any way of figuring out how much benefits will decrease for these recipients, or does it really depend on each individual's case?
Actually, we have been able to calculate the amount that families, that households will lose. So a family of four will lose approximately $36 a month or almost $400 a year in their food budget. A family of three will lose about $30 a month. And so for a family of three, that ends up being about 16 of the meals that they have right now will be lost monthly for that family when these cuts go into effect.
And are there other programs that could help fill that gap for them?
A lot of the secondary food assistance programs that there are, such as food banks and food pantries and other donation services like that, have already seen such a huge increase in need because of how high unemployment has been and how high the need has been. Also, 2 years ago, we made a budget decision to stop giving a charitable deduction on our taxes. And so that donation incentive has really gone away, and the amount of food that is available for people in the community has reduced drastically as well. So there isn't going to be anything out there to fill this gap, which is what really scares us.
Let's look at the big picture here, Melissa. When we talk as a nation, and there's been much talk about reining in out-of-control government spending, we certainly heard that as the debt ceiling crisis loomed. Is it not fair to say, look, that boost in benefits was temporary, and it was designed to help the nation over the worst of the recession, and now the nation's economy is recovering, so...
So the thing I find so interesting is that it isn't food assistance benefits or the people that are receiving them that got us into this bad economic situation in the first place. And the savings that we can find from cutting these programs is not going to be what we need to actually change our economy and make it grow and create more jobs. This is really not about ending temporary benefits to people who are on the program too long, because all the evidence shows that people aren't on it too long. People are still in need. This is about targeting particular groups as being lazy or not contributing enough or not bootstrapping up enough, and so deciding that they must not need food assistance, even though there are, for every one open job in the United States, there are three unemployed people still.
Now, the Farm Bill, as we know, is being debated in Congress, and the SNAP program is in line for deeper cuts. The Senate version of the Farm Bill would cut $4 billion. The House version would cut $40 billion. Where do you see this winding up?
So they're going to conference committee, actually going to be the first meeting where they're going to start trying to hammer out these two very different bills between the $4 billion and $40 billion and seeing where we can come with some sort of a solution. It's so hard to say, but this is honestly completely unprecedented in the history of SNAP, that we would have a nutrition title, the nutrition title of the House bill ripped out of the Farm Bill and run through separately. We've never seen that happen, and we've never seen these deep of cuts ever be suggested. So it's hard to say what's going to happen. We hope that we will have small cuts that recognize that we don't have enough jobs, that most of the people that are receiving food assistance are children, which will be cut off under these house cuts, and people with disabilities, which can be affected, and that we'll start to think about better ways that we can be using our money to help people get jobs, to help people become economically stable.
Do food assistance recipients need to learn to expect less from Uncle Sam on a permanent basis?
Yes, but I would like to say that most people who receive food assistance don't live on a permanent basis on it anyway. But they are going to, after already being pushed out of jobs, about 80% of people who can work that receive food assistance either are working or have worked within the past year or within a year after leaving food assistance. So people really do use it as a temporary stopgap when they lose jobs. But they are going to have to find some way to feed their families and to make ends meet, even with all of these cuts and with so much less available to them. So it really is going to be quite a chore.
Melissa Smith is a senior policy analyst for the Michigan League for Public Policy, and she was kind enough to join us today from Lansing. Melissa, thank you very much.
Thanks again for having me.
If you live in the part of Michigan that gets lake effect snow, you might not want to dally in getting your shovel out from the back of the garage or getting that snow thrower tuned up and gassed up ready for duty. MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa thinks we could be in for an early dose of lake effect snow. And Mark, did I see you use the words shovels and shovels of snow?
Yes, you did.
Now, you say you've projected a map for November 8th that looks like something you would see on December 25th?
Yeah, here's the scoop on lake effect. You need a warm lake, and you need cold air moving over it. And what I'm seeing is there's a cold pocket of air up in Canada that right now is about the strength of, sometimes we wouldn't see that until late December or early January.
Hmm.
If that cold pocket can come down into Michigan before the lakes cool down, then you've got the two ingredients for heavier than normal lake effect snow. Now, some people say, well, we always get heavy lake effect snow. But what I'm talking about is it would be heavier than the normal lake effect. The other part of the formula, the warm water on Lake Michigan and Lake Superior and Lake Huron, that's there also. Lake Michigan on average right now is 5 degrees warmer than it was this time last year. Now, 5 degrees might not sound like a whole lot, but that makes a lot of energy, and that increases the chance of lake effect snow.
What's with this big blob of cold Canadian air?
Who knows? In the realm of global warming, if it's happening, you shouldn't have an intense cold blob of air. But this blob started to form last November, and it held up in Canada, and we didn't know if it would come down, and it finally came down last February, and the weather pattern changed about then from a long period above normal temperatures for months and months and months to generally below normal temperatures all the way through spring, summer, and now it's turned around a little in the fall, but just a month period or so. And I think that cold has an easier time coming down now than it did last year, because it's already there and the existing pattern is for kind of the trend to be colder than normal.
So apart from lake effect snow that could be earlier and a lot heavier, could this add up to at least a colder winter for all of Michigan?
Yes, if that pocket stays strong and Mother Nature doesn't do an about face, then yes, it would mean lake effect. It would mean colder than normal temperatures in Michigan. And you can't separate lake effect from regular snow for the rest of us that don't get lake effect. It would also probably translate to a good amount of regular snow for the rest of the state.
What kind of timetable are you thinking, Mark? Are we thinking before Thanksgiving?
I'm thinking probably somewhere November 15th to about Thanksgiving will be our first 3 to 6 inch lake effect snow, or maybe heavier. And I think that the rest of the state may have a few inches too by Thanksgiving. I think we're talking more white Thanksgiving than white Christmas this year.
Well, we'll keep that in mind as we get closer to Thanksgiving. MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa, who also runs the website farmerweather.com. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
That lively reel could well have been played at some country crossroads dance in County Clare, Ireland, but you are listening to a fiddler named Patrick Bonner, recorded on Beaver Island, Michigan in 1938. It's part of a treasure trove of recordings made by the famed folklorist Alan Lomax as he prowled through Michigan on his legendary 10-year cross-country trip collecting American folk music during the Depression. He did it for the Library of Congress. Now Alan Lomax's hundreds of Michigan recordings are being presented in a traveling exhibition from the Michigan State University Museum. It's called Michigan Legacy, Grand Discoveries from the Great Depression. It opens this Friday, November 1st, at the Denos Museum Center in Traverse City, and it'll run until January 5th. Joining us now is Dr. Lori Summers. She's a folklorist and ethnomusicologist and Michigan's program coordinator for the Lomax Michigan Legacy Project. Welcome to the program, Lori.
Thank you.
And we are pleased to welcome Todd Harvey, the curator of the Alan Lomax Collection at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. That's where you will find the largest archive of recorded folk music in the world. Todd joins us now from Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Cindy.
Todd, start by telling us, who was Alan Lomax?
Well, Alan Lomax was specifically the assistant in charge of the archive of American folk song during the 1930s. And this was a small archive that was charged with the enviable task of documenting all of American folk song. And they did a pretty good job, but it was obviously an impossible task. Alan Lomax went on to be one of the most famous folklorists in 20th century America, because he made so many recordings of people who would later become famous, Woody Guthrie, Muddy Waters. His first intern was a young man named Pete Seeger in 1940.
Wow.
And he went on to have a very long and distinguished career.
And what was behind this mission to get out there and try to record every folk song that he could find and every artist in tune? What was behind that?
Well, I think that the folks at the Library of Congress in the late 1920s saw that regional America was changing with the rise of the mass media and, population shifts and things like that. And they recognized that expressive culture was important and that we should try to document it, and that, you know, the songs of ordinary Americans were just as important as the president's papers that filled the Library of Congress at the time. And so they hired first a man named Robert Winslow Gordon, and then the Lomaxes, John A. Lomax and his son Alan Lomax, to carry on the task.
I might also add that Lomax was able to build on a number of regional collections that had been going on really throughout the first half of the 20th century, and I think the 1930s were what I like to call sort of a golden age of collecting of ballads and regional materials. And so although he was a marvelous collector, he didn't do it all by himself. He was able to pull on the ongoing work of collectors. For example, here in Michigan, there were two collectors in particular that he used as springboards and actually who accompanied him in one case on his collecting, and that was E.C. Beck at what's now Central Michigan, who had been collecting the songs of the Michigan Lumberjacks, and Ivan Walton, who was a professor at the University of Michigan, who had begun to collect what he called the songs of the schoonermen, or the songs of the great age of sailing ships on the Great Lakes. And part of the impetus for these regional collectors came kind of out of an intellectual quest to identify what was unique and distinctive about American culture as opposed to our roots in so many other parts of the world, especially Europe. Mm. And so it was part of a defining role of determining what was distinctive about American culture.
And the reason that he went to Michigan was because a couple of people, E.C. Beck and Sidney Robertson, told him that he should go to Michigan, and that there was wonderful music to be collected there. And for the most part, the Lomaxes during the early 1930s had been focused in the Deep South and the Upland South, and the library decided that it wanted to expand its collections, and so they sent their man into the field, into Kentucky in 1937, Ohio and Indiana in the spring of 1938, and then the Great Lakes trip in the fall of 1938.
And once he got here, you know, again, this was supposed to be a tour of the Lake States, which he defined as Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, and he had great contacts in all three states. But I think it should be a source of considerable pride to Michiganders that he became so enthralled with what he found in Michigan that he called it the most fertile ground for folk material that he had yet discovered. And this was a man who had, at the tender age of 23, as Todd said, been across most of the southern U.S. He'd been to the Bahamas, he'd been to Haiti, and yet he finds in Michigan the most fertile ground for folk material. He was really the first to look broadly at the Upper Peninsula, which is really what he was referring to with the most fertile ground. I like to think it was the entire state. He was enthralled with everything he found here, but when he got to the UP, he was almost beside himself with the richness of traditions that he found. And so he spent virtually his entire collecting trip in Michigan.
We're talking to Dr. Lori Summers, who's a folklorist, and also Todd Harvey, the curator of the Alan Lomax Collection at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. Lori, we opened up with a very lively Irish reel that I'm sure we danced to in my adult Irish step dancing class. It was extremely authentic and amazing to think that it was recorded on Beaver Island. Give us some sense of the other cultures he discovered in Depression-era Michigan.
Well, Alan Lomax took this swath across Michigan that began in Detroit and ended in the western UP. And, you know, today we think of, at least in terms of popular culture, we tend to think of Michigan in terms of Detroit and, you know, Motown and figures like Eminem or Bob Seger. But what Lomax was really interested in was the music of rural Michigan, although he did start in Detroit and he made some wonderful ethnic recordings and blues recordings there. But he went on to Mount Pleasant, where he recorded lumberjacks that had been identified by E.C. Beck, the folklorist working out of what's now Central Michigan. He was drawn to northeast corner of Michigan, to the small towns of Posen and Metz, where ethnographers had, as early as the 20s, had been looking at Polish traditions, and he recorded a large number of songs in both Polish and instrumentals and some in English there. He was in Traverse City, which is one reason we're, you know, the tour that we're doing of the state currently with Michigan Humanities Council funding is going to locations where Lomax recorded. And he crossed the Straits, and then in the Upper Peninsula, he was recording an additional lumberjack material. But here is where he really began to get at the richness of ethnic traditions, you know, all the ethnic groups, particularly that came to the Keweenaw Peninsula to work in mining or elsewhere in the UP to work in mining, and then were working in lumber camps and settled out to have farms. And it was a remarkable accomplishment of this survey. There were many things that he missed, but the number of things that he documented is extraordinary.
I'd like to have us take a listen to a Polish wedding march. You mentioned the village, tiny village of Posen. I think even in the last census, it had just slightly over more than 200 people. It's in the northeast Lower Peninsula. And this was a wedding march that would have accompanied the bride and groom to and from the church. Todd, what do these tunes and songs say about that point in our nation's history and the communities that produce them?
Well, I think in Michigan particularly, there were a lot of immigrant communities. There were a lot of people who had immigrated or were first generation, and those traditions that they brought with them from Poland, from Finland, were strong and were evolving. And that's really interesting to me. One of the weddings that he documented, in it was a Polish wedding in Detroit. He talks about how the older generation wanted polkas and the younger generation howled for jazz. And so you're seeing a melding of cultures that I think is particularly interesting in Michigan.
And it makes me wonder, Lori, how has the legacy of those singers and those musicians that Alan Lomax recorded 75 years ago, how is that impacting Michigan's music scene in 2013?
Well, I think that's one of the things that we're trying to pull out when we do this this tour for the 75th anniversary commemoration, is that some of these songs are still sung, but if the songs are not still sung or performed, the communities that Lomax recorded are still there and are carrying on of the traditions. You know, of Polish community in Posen has polka bands there every Labor Day weekend for their potato fest. The Finnish music in the Upper Peninsula that Lomax recorded is alive and well and thriving in today's manifestation. So that really the roots of who we are as a state were documented by Lomax. And, you know, he was recording in 1938, but you have to understand that the repertoire that he was teasing out of the people that he recorded with this big, bulky Presto disc recorder was, in many cases, repertoire that had been in its prime and active in the late 19th century. This was the golden age of Great Lakes sailing. You know, the late 19th and early 20th century was the heyday of the lumber industry. Mining has had its ups and downs, but, you know, the miners were on relief and having pretty hard times in 1938. But these traditions that had been passed on in the communities and families from generation to generation had even deeper roots. So what we're seeing is the building blocks of who we are today, and I think we are a state whose strength has always been in its diversity, and that have a tremendous ethnic richness, and I think that's really one of the more powerful legacies that the Lomax collection has.
Let's take a listen to another Lomax recording. This is a singer named Carl Lathrop. He was recorded in the town of St. Louis in Gratiot County, pretty much right at the center of the Lower Peninsula. The song is called "One More a Lumbering Go."
All your sons of freedom, and listen to my theme. Come all your roving lumberjacks that run the Saginaw Stream. We'll cross the Pitiwati where the mighty waters flow. And we'll roam the wild woods over and once more a lumbering go. And once more a
Todd and Lori, you have both made folk music your life's passion, as did Alan Lomax. And I want the thoughts of both of you. Why is it so important to keep these songs and tunes alive?
Well, I think one answer to why it's important is that these songs are, you know, it's the music of everyday people. It's something that we share. It's our legacy. It's our collective memory. And these are tunes that help remind us who we are. They remind us where we come from. They kind of get at the heart and root of community culture. I mean, we tend to be, you know, obsessed with popular culture and with, you know, the sounds of symphonies and of, you know, what we hear on the top 40 and what you can download, you know, from your iPad from the major recording artists of the day. And I don't want to, you know, that's important. But this is the kind of music that is really integrally tied to community and family and regional culture. And I think that's why it's important to continue it. And actually now, thanks to the Library of Congress, you're going to be able to download it in a few months just like you could any other kind of music. And that's part of the whole effort here with the 75th anniversary is there's an element of a powerful element of access and a powerful element of repatriation of these tunes back to the families and communities of origin. And we've already been in contact, and Todd knows this well, too, with family members of people who were recorded by Lomax who are quite thrilled with this entire process.
Well, Todd, tell us, what will the Library of Congress be doing? Lori mentioned we'll be able to download.
Sure. Michigan State University Museum has undertaken public programming, and Lori's coordinating that, and it's very, very exciting. The Library of Congress has created an e-publication that will be available through the iBook store on November 1st, and we're doing a series of 22 podcasts as well. And finally, we're going to loft the entire collection of audio, 250 disc recordings, onto the library's website sometime this winter. And so we think that these actions and these activities will allow the communities to decide, oh my gosh, this is really interesting stuff. We should continue this tradition, or we already continue it. And look how it sounded 75 years ago.
If I could just toot Todd's horn and just add to this just a little bit. I mean, what he didn't say is he's the author of this e-book.
Right.
I have to say that I think it's tremendously exciting that Michigan is actually kind of the test state and the test collection for a new approach that the Library of Congress is trying to make these recordings more accessible. You know, there've been a number of the Lomax recordings have been available for download on the web, not the Michigan recordings, but other Lomax recordings for some time. But this is kind of a multi-pronged, collaborative attempt to provide access and interpretation of a library collection, and Michigan is the subject. And you can see clips of the color film footage he took, see the telegrams that he sent. Some of them were quite humorous. Some of them are quite woeful, of a young man who's running out of money in a strange place. But it's an incredibly exciting and rich collaboration. And the e-book, I think, just is a marvelous contribution.
That was folklorist Lori Summers, who is Michigan's program coordinator for the Alan Lomax Project. And she was joined by Todd Harvey from the Library of Congress. And as they were discussing his new e-book, it's entitled Michigan I.O., Alan Lomax and the 1938 Library of Congress Folk Song Expedition. And it's available beginning today at iBooks for your iPad. And for more information on the 75th anniversary of Alan Lomax's 1938 field trip recording through Michigan or Todd's ebook, you can go to our website, the stateside link at michiganradio.org. We have all the links there for you. Lori, Todd, thank you so much for talking with us today and sharing Alan's story.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is not only Halloween, it is Thursday, and that means it's time to talk with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Always good to talk to you, sir.
Good to talk with you.
So it's been kind of a week of contrast, in your opinion.
Yes, it really has. I mean, on Monday we sat in front of a TV screen and watched the sitting governor of the state of Michigan for the first time in anyone's memory testify in federal court about something that decisions that he made, and that was Rick Snyder talking in bankruptcy court. It was interesting to watch. Here's a guy who is very well educated. He's got a law degree from Michigan, an MBA, is a CPA. And a lot of the questions he would respond with, I don't recall, or he would invoke attorney-client privilege. And it made you feel a little uneasy. On the other hand, some other things came out that I thought were very interesting. There's a lot of emails that showed that the administration in the run-up to bankruptcy, even with about a week before the bankruptcy filing, was clearly trying to slow things down a little bit and take a more measured approach, with his general counsel even writing an email to the inner circle around the governor suggesting that maybe the governor invoke his powers to put conditions on any bankruptcy filing, and which would have included, if you wanted to do anything on pensions, for example, that they would need the governor's approval, or to sell assets of a certain value, think DIA pieces or think water department, things like that.
Sure.
They would need his approval. They talked to him about it. He decided against doing that. So there were no conditions placed upon it, which is essentially, I think, a way to give Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, the green light to do a restructuring the way he thinks needs to be done.
So carte blanche.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. You just commented something I want to ask you about. You said hearing Rick Snyder saying, I don't recall, I don't remember, made you uneasy. Why?
Well, you know, I think it suggests to people clearly that he or his administration may have something to hide. He may also not recall. But any time I think you do that, it raises a suspicion among people that are doing listening. So, I mean, what are they not saying? What do we not know? I think some of that is understandable. And clearly, attorney-client privilege goes both ways. So, I mean, anybody can invoke that in a situation like that. It's not just something that he can do.
Sure.
But this is somebody who's been a real champion of transparency, and there have been times when things get dicey that he becomes a little less transparent. That said, the fact that he did testify at all, I think, is very remarkable.
So let's shift gears now from, as you say, a week of contrast from the dire state of Detroit's finances. And then the Business Leaders for Michigan, which is the state's most prominent business roundtable, held its CEO summit this week in Detroit. What were your impressions? What did you hear?
Well, I thought it was very upbeat in general. I think a lot of people look at the bankruptcy, a lot of business people look at the bankruptcy as an unfortunate but necessary restructuring that needs to happen. I think they see this more as a trailing indicator of where Detroit is and where it's going than a leading indicator, which is more what you see elsewhere around the country. And in fact, that was one of the things they talked about is the different perceptions of Michigan and Detroit around the country. And they're very different here. In general, I think people were very positive about what they see happening in the business community. What I thought was really remarkable was here you had this collection of CEOs, and there wasn't a single automotive person involved in this thing from top to bottom.
Really?
Yeah, with a lot of companies from the west side of the state, companies like Lazy Boy and Meyer and Two Men in a Truck out of Lansing, about how they've attacked the business challenges and essentially remade their businesses. Entrepreneurs from Detroit and Ann Arbor about the entrepreneurial culture in Michigan. I think in general it was very much upbeat, and people are really looking kind of past where Detroit is at City Hall and really looking down the road at what's going to happen in the mayoral election. How is that going to impact the restructuring of the city going forward? It's really not, there's not a lot of backward looking stuff here.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with a look back on very much a week of contrast. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Let's stay in Detroit for a moment. There's a bike shop there right next to the Rensen. It puts on all kinds of guided bike tours through the city. Wheelhouse Detroit has tours of churches, urban agriculture, and painted murals. There's also the Haunted Detroit Tour, which reporter Kyle Norris took last night. She has this audio postcard from downtown Detroit. It begins with bike rider Wendy Pirelli.
It's a beautiful fall evening, and it's sunny, barely any wind. It's going to be a great night for a bike ride. This is not something we normally do. So this is the first time we've done this. My sister hasn't biked in probably 30 years, so it's a big deal.
I'm not sure, are these the streets here? So Lafayette East, heading up DeQuindercut, coming down. Oh, we're coming down Cass. That's beautiful.
Stick around with me, okay? I don't know how fast I could go.
I got you, man.
Dude, you just see me trying to ride, okay? Don't worry.
All right, guys. Everybody on the tour can come over this way.
I'm Mark. I'm the tour guide for the Haunted Detroit Bike Tour from the Wheelhouse Detroit. We're going to find some old haunted spots, go through some cemeteries, the old contours of Detroit.
My name is Tony, and I'm one of the sweepers here for the Wheelhouse Tours. I'm an on-road mechanic, basically. You will be taking around through some of the more desolate parts of the city to see and hear stories about places that did exist and do exist still. And maybe talk about a few ghosts here and there. Maybe see one, hopefully.
We're going to go through Eastern Market, which is our open-air produce market. On St. Aubin here, this was a huge area for a Purple Gang back in the day. We all know who the Purple Gang is.
No.
Gangsters from the 20s running booths from Detroit or from Canada in Detroit. They were huge. So over here at 3587 St. Aubin, which is in this section right here on the other side of the street there, unfortunately, the house doesn't stand there anymore. But there's a man named Benny de Baptista. And he was a self-proclaimed prophet. And he would do ceremonies in his basement and stuff. Unfortunately for him, when the police finally entered the home of this gentleman, they found him in the office. And he was in his office here in his very nice clothes, perfectly sitting there with his arms crossed his chest, sitting in his chair. Unfortunately, his head was down at his feet. You know, typical gangland type scenario gone on. Also, his family, his four children, his one son and three daughters and his wife, they were also found in the house as well, but they were completely not given the fortune of being just your head severed off. They were completely thrashed and slashed, I guess you would say. So, anyway, so that's that over there.
We are at Elmwood Cemetery. We're right outside the gates of the cemetery. There's a fireman's plot. Coleman Young is buried here. Some of the Stroh's family. Lewis Cass is buried here. The Woodbridge family. It's kind of like the who's who.
Also, this is a cool one. Older folks would know this one. Martha Jean the Queen is here. First African-American woman. Or not the first, but a very notable radio celebrity in Detroit. She used to do AM radio. It was on the Gospel Channel. She was on WJLP. She was also in the movie Detroit 9000. Have anybody seen that? Yeah? So apparently somebody's giggling. Because she was in that movie also. And they also filmed the chase scene where they're shooting at each other in here. We're going to go this way. And we're going to get a nice view of this ridge in this place. This is like the best view in this cemetery.
Especially when you're on the ground.
Hey, my name is Sean Curvillo, and I just did the haunted bike tour here in Detroit. It was awesome. I recommend everyone else to do it. The cemetery was awesome. That was just the history, just to see Detroit as it's and it's majestic. And then the Masonic Temple, which is another majestic building in Detroit. Just seeing how it was in the Roaring Twenties, when you see those old buildings, you see the architecture, you see that. I think that was more of the haunting than anything, to see how just a... Imagine back when the city was in its heyday, and that's what I got to say was more of the haunting to me on this tour. I just thought it was just great because I could feel Detroit. When you're in a car, you really don't feel that. But when you're riding a bike, that vibe just goes through you, and you just feel the pulse or the beat. I know that sounds corny, but I just felt the pulse and beat of Detroit today.
Pumpkins, costumes, pounds and pounds of candy. So just where did this tradition of Halloween come from, and how far back does the holiday go here in Michigan? Let's turn to our resident stateside historian for the answers. Bill Loomis, good to have you here.
Thanks, Cindy.
Well, you know, it strikes me that if you were one of the early settlers here on the Michigan frontier, the ones who, say, came in the early 1800s from, oh, let's say New England with that stern Protestant background, you would not be particularly inclined to be dressing up like a goblin or a witch.
Exactly.
So who brought Halloween to Michigan?
Yeah, it really came over with the Scottish and Irish immigrants, and they started coming over in the 1840s. The first mention of Halloween in the papers was in the 1860, really, when it started to become more popular.
So as these early settlers came over from Scotland and Ireland, what kind of traditions and ideas about Halloween did they bring?
It was basically a rural holiday. It was done in the country, and essentially people gathered around the hearth on Halloween night and told ghost stories and did simple games like roasting chestnuts in the fireplace and breaking open kale stalks and things like this was over in Scotland. Mm-hmm. To predict the future, young people would say, who's my true love and all that sort of thing. And when it came to Detroit, it basically was a repeat of that.
So this is what it was really about and tied in, of course, with the church holiday.
Right.
Of All Souls Day and All
right.
Saints Day.
That's right.
The idea that we had spirits about.
Yeah, there was all kinds of stuff like that on those creepy nights.
The games that you described that they were playing, like picking raisins from the fire.
Yeah.
What was up with that?
Well, I don't know. I think there was some boredom that figured into some of these games. I don't know. But they did a lot of simple games that involved fruit and nuts and cakes and things like that. But also there was always a little element of danger in some of the games. They did one where they would spin an apple and there was a candle on the other end and you had to grab the apple without getting burned.
There's also something to do with herring.
Yeah, that was kind of a severe test. But a young lady had to eat a whole raw herring, bones and all, in 3 bites. And then she went to bed, and in her dream, she would see her true love.
I think it would be her culinary nightmare, actually.
Probably a fisherman or
something.
Something.
That's pretty funny. How about the jack-o'-lantern?
Jack-o'-lanterns were popular even before that. There were talks of, you know, back in the turn of the century, even in New England, jack-o'-lanterns were around. And they weren't in Scotland, so they dealt mainly with kale and fall vegetables like cabbage. But pumpkins and jack-o'-lanterns were carved right away, as well as other vegetables. They carved gourds and cabbages and all sorts of other things. It wasn't just pumpkins.
And I'd heard the Irish kind of brought that. They used to carve turnips even and
yep,
put them in the
right.
cottage
turnips
windows too. So.
That's right. Or they would carry them with candles in them and things like that.
I'm speaking with Bill Loomis as we go over some of the history of Halloween in Michigan. You write about the popularity. There was a spell of real popular activity with communicating with the dead through mediums in Michigan from about the latter 1800s to around 1920. And then it was so poignant when you explain why, that it tied in with the post-Civil War and post-World
yeah.
War One era where
yes.
people had lost husbands and sons.
Right, right, right. It was just awful. I think death was much more prevalent. Not more prevalent, but it was more a part of life.
Yes.
People died younger, and so there was a more of a need maybe to communicate and kind of straighten out your life and how these people left things unfinished. So the Civil War was a huge rise in the interest in that, in seances and Ouija boards and telepathy and all kinds of things like that. Even hypnotism came around. Spirit photography was real popular. They were all, aside from a few things, they were all considered frauds eventually, but
right.
people had strong interest. And there's also much higher infant mortality. So it was very popular among women. It was considered actually progressive because at one point, several historians, in fact, Barbara Goldsmith in particular, said 10 million people considered themselves strong believers in this sort of activity in the United States alone. So it was a real popular common thing to follow.
Now, the idea of trick or treat, as you point out, in these early days of the 20th century, there weren't any treats. There were just tricks. And
yeah.
I can tell you, my dad grew up in Ferndale in the 1920s, and I can remember him telling us how he and the boys would go out and, like, tip over outhouses. Ha,
yeah.
ha, ha, ha.
Right.
But that was their idea of Halloween fun. So there was actually, as you described, some of the young folk really did misbehave badly.
Yeah, that was permitted, though. Somehow this mischievous boy cultural icon was allowed. So they did some pretty horrible things. One paper reported that kids had stretched almost invisible piano wire across the sidewalk, and when people went walking by, they would trip on the wire. One fellow broke his shoulder. It was, you know, it could be pretty vicious, but most of it was soaping windows, but they would throw vegetables at people. They'd throw dried corn at cars, you know, small things.
But then the costume idea, the begging, you know, putting your costume on and going door to door, I was surprised that as I was doing it as a little girl in the, you know, 1950s, early 60s, we were kind of in the forefront. That was pretty new.
Yeah, that was pretty new. Up until World War II, kids didn't really trick or treat. There was a sugar shortage in World War II. It was rationed, and it was too expensive for people to give out candy to total strangers. So it wasn't really didn't really catch on until the 50s.
What made it catch on? What where did it all begin with? Let's send the kids out with their little pillowcases or their bags, and they go begging.
You know, that's a good question, but it appeared in shows like Ozzie and Harriet and other TV show. Suddenly kids were trick-or-treating on the show, and from there on it really took off.
Now, today when you know, you hear trick-or-treating, you go to the door, you see kids coming up like tiny Spider-Men,
yeah,
complete with their bulging foam biceps, I might add. But
right.
What kind of costumes were they wearing costumes even before the trick-or-treating?
They were. The kids wore costumes back at the turn of the century, but they didn't go trick-or-treating. They just kind of dressed up and
pranced around and
caused mayhem.
Strung piano wire.
That's right.
What kind of costumes might we have seen?
Well, they were based on fairy tales, and then other just popular images like the little Dutch boy or girl. That was a popular one. But generally, it was a reflection of what they were reading at the time.
Okay. And you also pointed out it was considered rather fun to dress up as the opposite sex.
Yeah. That was a tradition. Little boys and girls, like age 6 or 7, they would dress as girls, and the little girls dress as boys. And the boys wore wigs, and they dressed in frilly dresses, and they would go around.
It was a hoot.
Yeah, that was fun.
Bill Loomis, special writer for the Detroit News. His piece on the history of Halloween in Michigan and Detroit appeared in last Sunday's Detroit News. Always a pleasure, Bill. Thank you so
much. Thanks, Cindy.
So are you dressed up for Halloween? And if so, as what? Let us know. You can find us on Twitter at Stateside Radio and on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And while you're there, we've posted some photos of our Halloween celebration here at Michigan Radio today. One of our favorite costumes, Mark Brush, who edits the website, dressed as the emergency manager of Oz. Our intrepid producer, Zoe Clark, is channeling her inner Jackie Kennedy. I myself am Snow White's evil queen today. You know, I used to be Snow White, but then I drifted. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Bob Scott, who came dressed as a hardworking engineer. Contributors are Kyle Norris, Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.